This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In Washington, all eyes are on Congress as representatives and senators wrestle with how to pass a coronavirus aid package that can get enough support from both major parties and a signature from President Trump to get money out to Americans and states in desperate need of support. Here's what Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy had to say on the Senate floor Monday. Wearing a mask, he spoke to his colleagues about the need for a coronavirus aid package now.
My state of Vermont is like everywhere else. Healthcare workers, caregivers, business owners, employees, teachers, and students, all in need of support in these difficult and uncertain times. We have families wrestling with heightened food insecurity, people who, for the first time in their lives, they can't feed their children, they can't feed themselves. They have the threat of eviction hanging over them.
But Republicans and Democrats both have demands that some of them say are hard and fast in order for them to sign, or to vote, rather. So can they find a compromise before the Christmas recess? Joining us today to talk about where he stands and what else he's working on in Washington is Vermont's Representative Peter Welch. Congressman Welch, welcome back to the show. We'll see if we can get Peter Welch on the line with us. I believe it's just
Thank you. Technical connection.
There we go. We got you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So a busy morning. We've been hearing about House negotiations over a stopgap measure to actually keep the government running so that you can continue to look at what needs to be done for coronavirus aid. Can you just talk a little bit as we go live here in the noon hour about where things stand with that?
Well, they can. I mean, there's been significant progress. There's this bipartisan group of senators with the support of a number of us in the House that have proposed this $908 billion compromise. And as you remember, the House passed a package 7 months ago, and it hasn't been acted on by Senator McConnell. But we now have a number of Republican senators who are advocating for a compromise, and there are many of us, myself included, who would like a bigger package, but really think doing something, whatever it is we can do now, is essential, and really for all those reasons that Senator Leahy cited in his opening comments. Right now, the way it stands is that there's real indications that the House would agree to what is that Senate bipartisan proposal. President Trump has indicated that he would support a package that's somewhat different, that is about $10 billion higher. And the person that actually has the final say here, just because of the way Senate rules work, is Senator McConnell, who's been, unfortunately, resistant to an additional aid package from day one.
So what are your thoughts then about what Leader McConnell is going to do?
Well, see, I think essentially the urgency that's being conveyed by some of his Republican colleagues who are breaking ranks and are saying some of the same things that Senator Leahy is saying about what's happening to people in the states they represent, I think in the end of the day is going to move us to pass some relief that's going to help us get through the end of the year and into next year. You know, the reality of this is that the impact of COVID, the health consequences, they're really universal. Whether you're in a red state or a blue state, whether you're the president of the United States or a frontline worker, you can get sick. And we've had many people die. That knows no political ideology. The economic consequences are very much the same. You know, when I talk to my Republican colleagues in the House about what's happening to their restaurants, what's happening to their nonprofits, these local businesses that are so essential to the local economy and makes their towns special, the situation they face is identical to what we face in Vermont. So the economic pain here is universal as well. So I'm seeing many of my Republican colleagues acknowledge that there would be enormous benefit and urgency that we pass a relief package. And I think that, unfortunately, Senator McConnell does not have that view, but he is now receiving some pressure from his Republican Senate colleagues. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to get there, but we should have been there quite long ago.
Congressman Welch, I'm glad we jumped right into the coronavirus aid package, but my understanding is that the House is going to vote today on a continuing resolution to keep the government funded and running for a week, which will give you a little bit more time to actually come to terms on this coronavirus aid package. That vote has not happened yet as of noon, correct?
That's correct, but it will take place and we'll keep the lights on for another week. And that will mean negotiations continue. You know, on this aid package, this is what I think is frustrating for a lot of Vermonters, and certainly for me. We've got hope. You know, the vaccine was administered in Great Britain yesterday to a 90-year-old woman.
99, I think, wasn't she?
99, yeah, and it's there. And we are on one side of the river, looking across the bridge, and we can get there, but it's going to take time for the vaccine to be distributed, for us to get our place in line to get that, and then for all of us when we get vaccinated to really have the immunity that is what is essential. But between now and then, whether it's late summer or into the fall, we've got to do two things. One, individually, we've got to continue to do everything we can to keep ourselves safe, and by keeping ourselves safe, keep our neighbors safe. But number two, the federal government, it's the only governmental entity that has the fiscal flexibility and the fiscal capacity to help us get through economically. And what we have to do, in my view, is make certain that those restaurants that have been hanging on by their fingernails, those local nonprofits, those families that are struggling to put meals on the table for their kids, we cannot leave them behind. When we get to the other side of that bridge and we have that vaccine, we don't want to leave those businesses that have been working so hard to hang in. We don't want to leave them behind. And that's going to take us providing some additional relief so that we can get to a healthy place and a self-sustaining recovery.
We'll talk a little bit about how that works then in this second round of aid, should it go through. Because, you know, in the first package, there was some discretion, but not total discretion, for states in how they wanted to distribute that funding. And we heard a lot about that from Governor Scott when sometimes he would get questions about, you know, why don't you just plug the budget gap for the state with some of the money that you're getting from the federal government? And, you know, he would say, we can't do that. There are strings attached to this money, and you can only put it towards specific COVID relief or coronavirus aid or things that have been impacted by COVID-19. But there have been a lot of calls from state governments and municipalities who say, look, our budgets are impacted by COVID-19. And if we don't get some relief that allows us to use the federal money toward filling our budget gaps, then we are not going to be able to continue to offer other safety net programs or to be able to support our communities. So how are you negotiating that sort of flexibility around how states are going to be able to use the money in the bill?
All right. Well, there's two issues here. Number one, I am totally in favor of flexibility. We saw that to the extent Vermont had some flexibility, it made much better decisions, I think, with the governor and the legislature close to home allocating those resources to best benefit Vermonters and Vermont businesses so they could hang on. So I'm completely in favor of flexibility. In the CARES, the package that we passed in the House but hasn't been acted on in the Senate, does give that flexibility to the state of Vermont. But the second issue, which is really much more problematic, is that one of the points of contention in the next bill is, do we continue to provide aid to the states and localities? I believe we have to, because as you mentioned, the fiscal impact on the states has been brutal, and it's resulting in job losses, and it's in areas of like public education, public safety, things that are really important. And Senator McConnell is adamantly opposed to providing more aid to the states, and he's characterized it as a blue state bailout. And of course, that's completely untrue, because every state has been hammered economically as a result of COVID. So I do believe that, A, we have to provide additional assistance to state and local governments, and number two, they have to have flexibility to best use that to meet the needs of their citizens.
And so that would include in this round allowing states to use it to plug budget gaps and budget holes in a way that they weren't allowed in that first package.
That's right. There was also a provision in there that the states had to spend everything or lose it, you know, spend it right. or lose it by December 31. And I am sponsoring legislation that's in the House package that would extend that date for a year. So flexibility, I believe, is important, but more funding for state and local municipalities is really important.
So, Congressman, when you talk about the need to support families that are really struggling and small businesses that are worried about being able to ever open up again or to be able to succeed, and particularly the hospitality industry, which you mentioned, restaurants, which we know are just crippled by the regulations and by the impact of COVID-19, how do you balance that desire for flexibility so states have the ability to use the money where and how and when they need it with some control over making sure that states are using it to support businesses and restaurants and programs and people that Congress thinks should be priorities? Like, just fundamentally, how do you strike the right balance?
Well, actually, it's pretty straightforward, and we did that in the CARES package. Number one, people got a $1,200 check. That made a huge difference for a lot of families. Number two, they got additional unemployment. You know, we had 5 million people on a single day lose their jobs and their health care. And by getting some extended and supplemental unemployment, that really helped them. And they had the flexibility to decide how to deal with this financial pressure that was suddenly visited upon them. Third, with businesses, and this helped restaurants, we had the payroll protection plan. And that meant that the restaurant could pay employees, keep them on the payroll in the hopes that the virus would be behind us. Now, it's turned out that when we passed that last March, there was some hope that we'd be somewhere back to normal by the end of the year. Of course, that's not true. We're in worse shape now with the infection rate than we were then. But that gave the individuals, it gave the businesses flexibility about how to manage. And then when you had money that goes directly to the states, they had flexibility, as we saw here, where our governor and our legislature provided some money for farms, provided some money for our hospitality industry, which in our state is huge, and they are suffering because every time the phone rings, it's a cancellation as opposed to a new booking. So you can have flexibility, but allocation of resources to where they're needed. Individuals, the businesses, let them be flexible in how they use it. And with the state, where it has to be accountable, of course, but you give them flexibility because they are going to be making that decision. And frankly, I really do trust the governor and our legislature to be tight with what they're doing and really demand accountability.
Do you trust all states to do it that way?
If we have the restrictions that we can have is it has to be used for general services. You know, some of the Republican colleagues were arguing that if we gave money to the states, they would just bail out profligate spending from the past, particularly where there were pension problems.
Which Vermont and certainly has, too. I mean, we have outstanding pension obligations that are a real problem for us.
That's right. So I do think that where the money is coming from the federal government to the state, the guidelines or the guardrails would be you're using this to address COVID-related expenses, not pre-existing issues that are of the state's own responsibility. And I think pensions are in that category.
What about, you mentioned that in the first package, of course, as we remember, there were expanded unemployment benefits that not only were expanded in terms of the amount of money that people who were receiving unemployment benefits could get, but who could actually get unemployment benefits. And there's been a lot of concern about what happens as these programs expire. So give us the details of what you think, I mean, knowing that we don't know what the final package is going to look like, what you think people might be able to expect, $300? Is that sort of the reasonable compromise?
That's the compromise that the Senate bill offers, and I think it'll probably be in the final bill. But there's two parts to unemployment that are really important. One is the amount of money and access to it, but the second is who does qualify. Because traditionally, if you are a self-employed person or if you were an independent contractor, you were not eligible for unemployment. And just think of how many folks in Vermont, you know, they drive a snowplow in the winter. They may do some landscaping in the summer. They're independent contractors. They were out of work in many cases. So the legislation we had made those folks eligible to get unemployment if, as a result of COVID, they were not doing the same amount of work. And I would foresee us including that in final legislation to continue it for independent contractors and for self-employed people. Lots and lots of Vermonters in that category.
So that's going to be a relief for people to know that your expectation is that those expanded categories will be included in the new bill and that there will be a somewhat expanded pool of money that people who are unemployed can expect to receive on a weekly basis.
That's really important to me, and the bipartisan compromise included that. So you had senators like Romney, okay, Republican-formed presidential candidate, who is in support of that. Now, McConnell's not, so we continue to have that problem. But what I'm seeing is significant movement on the part of the Republican senators to acknowledge that unemployment is still a real problem, and we've got to provide some relief. And again, I think what's important for all of us, especially those of us in Congress, to remember is that we're now talking about a temporary but really essential economic lifeline. The vaccine is here. And by the way, in terms of creating the vaccine, we had government working in an effective way. Now the challenge is to distribute it. But that's going to happen, and hopefully it'll be smooth. But even if it's smooth, it's going to take a while. Let's not leave folks behind when we can see the other side of the bridge. And if we hang in there, we can get there and bring as many people with us as possible.
Let's go to Tristram, who's calling in from Newfane. Hi, Tristram. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Congressman Welch. Nice to hear your voice. My question is the indigenous communities have suffered seriously over the last 8 months with pretty inadequate care, pretty inadequate attention. So I was curious about provisions in the new bill that will address specifically indigenous needs across the nation. Thank you.
Congressman Welch. Yeah.
Well, it's true. I mean, this is largely it's everywhere, but especially in the western states where, for instance, the Navajo Nation, many people may have heard the report on NPR last night about the incredibly high infection rate and the challenges to getting health care there. In the original CARES package, there was specific money that was allocated to try to address the really extreme needs of the indigenous peoples in this country. And my hope is that we would continue to try to double down on that commitment in any aid package that's finally passed.
Is there anything specific that you know about in the language that you've seen?
I don't know what the current state of the language is. There was significant money in the House bill that I voted in favor of that would have addressed that. But this is a fast-moving situation where what's the language right now may be not the language what it was yesterday or it will be tomorrow. But the point of the question here is really correct. There is immense suffering to a degree much greater in the indigenous community than many other parts of our country, even as the country is suffering quite a bit.
We got a note from Jonathan in Shrewsbury who says, I've always heard that in a negotiation, it's important for each party to put itself in the shoes of the other party if they hope to reach a compromise. So how would you articulate what you think is Senator McConnell's reasoning for holding up passage of what is obviously a desperately needed COVID relief bill?
Well, you know, that's a bit of a mystery to me about Senator McConnell. You know, there's a history here with him. You may remember that when President Obama was elected and Senator McConnell was the leader of the Senate, reporters asked him, what's your goal? And this was right after President was elected. And he said, my goal is to guarantee that Barack Obama is a one-term president. Mm-hmm. In all my life in politics, that's the most shocking thing I've ever heard anyone say. Because what, of course, we do here in Vermont, we have our election. You win some and you lose some. But when you get elected, your job is to help that Vermont be successful. So, you know, I was a state senator. I was Senate president when Jim Douglas got elected. And some people were urging me to be aggressive with him before he was even sworn in. I said, wait a minute. The same people that elected you, I was talking to my fellow state senators, elected him. We've got a common responsibility, and that's to fight as best we can for the success of Vermonters. And when McConnell said that about Obama, it tells you he's got a different agenda. His agenda has always been about trying to get the majority or maintain the majority for his party in the Senate. That's a legitimate goal, but it's not a legitimate tactic to act in a way where it all comes at the expense of the cooperation that's needed for the benefit of everybody in this country. And unfortunately, I think that is a big motivator for Mitch McConnell, even though it's not necessarily a motivator for many of his other colleagues in the Senate.
Yeah, so it sounds like in some ways you're finding it difficult to do what Jonathan was thinking about, where you put yourself in another person's shoes and sort of figure out how then you could reach compromise with them once you have a sense of understanding with them. I mean, it sounds like you're fundamentally opposed.
That's right. What Jonathan is talking about is what I think in life for most of us is the way we try to approach it. We have a situation that where there's disagreement and we want to get to an outcome. And in order to do that, you try to listen to the legitimate concerns of the person who has a different point of view. And we do that at town meeting. We do it in our negotiations at work with colleagues when we're trying to determine what's the best way to use our resources. That's the way most of us in life operate, and it's certainly the way we should operate in politics. But I think a lot of dismay among citizens is how much in politics is just about trying to get advantage. And, with Senator McConnell, my experience with him is that his primary goal is maintaining his position there and maintaining the majority. And again, I don't begrudge him the right to have those as important goals for him. But I do when he articulates it, where his goal is to essentially fight for failure, and that would be his path to success.
Yeah, interesting to note. I'm just looking up the statistics on how on his margin of victory in Kentucky in November of 2020, and you know he had almost 2/3 of the vote. He beat Amy McGrath 58% to 38%, and so you know it's striking to see that voters in Kentucky still support what he's doing and that approach. We got another question or note from Liz, and Liz is worried about adjournment. She writes, how can we get Congress to not adjourn for a vacation at this most critical time? Your primary job is to protect your people, and you are all, as far as I can see, failing at that.
First of all, I share her concern. I do not want to adjourn until we get something done. But in a legislative body where Senator McConnell has the final say as to whether the Senate is going to act, that's going to ultimately be an incredible decision that he makes that has real consequence no matter what the rest of us do. But the bottom line here is all of us in Congress should be taking a step back. This COVID threat to our lives and livelihoods is really affecting everybody, Republicans or Democrats. And everything that we do where it comes to getting the vaccine deployed to providing economic lifelines so we can get across that bridge are things that are good for every single American. So it's not the time for the different priorities of Republicans and Democrats to be fought out. It's a time for Democrats and Republicans to be doing what all of the people we represent need. And it's that lifeline to get over the bridge so we can get that vaccine and get back to normal.
Let's go to Greg. Greg's with us from Charlotte. Go right ahead, Greg.
Hi, Congressman Welch. Now that we've had a sociopath for a president, I'm wondering if some of the rules that we kind of took for granted in the past need to be formalized in law, like the emoluments clause and not spreading lies and trying to force a coup during after an illegal election.
Well, clearly the separation of powers and the balance of powers have been challenged by this president like no other. And I do think that we should take a look at the formalizing some of these checks and balances in an effort to make them more more important. One of the things that I think we should do actually is take a look at emergency powers that have been delegated to the president that was done by Congress with Republican and Democratic support, but at a time when people thought there'd be restraint by the president. For instance, the tariff authority that the president used, he invoked what was emergency authority, the authority that could be invoked in an emergency that threatened our national security. And he used that authority to impose tariffs on Canadian aluminum. Now, most of us who live in Vermont along the border with Canada regard Canada as our really good friend and trade partner and cultural ally. They're not our national security threat. So this was an abuse, in my view, of presidential authority, of emergency powers that in a different circumstance might be appropriate. So I do think we have to revisit all of these things to try to establish a more historic norm of the separation of powers.
You know, you may have either heard the interview on NPR last night or read the article that Zeynep Tufekci wrote in The Atlantic about whether or not we should be calling the actions by President Trump refusing to concede the election, continuing to file lawsuits and continuing to bully and encourage others in other states to do the same, whether we should call that a coup. And Tufekci writes, you know, there are a lot of words in Turkish that are maybe more specific than coup, but perhaps since coup is the one that we have in English, we should be thinking about using that word. Is that a word that you are comfortable with? How would you describe what you believe President Trump is doing?
What he's doing is outrageous and really dangerous. Our whole democracy depends on the peaceful transfer of power. And one of the most memorable experiences I had in Washington was after George Bush, at the inauguration of President Obama. And it's all out on the front steps. And then you go to the east side of the Capitol, and it's not reviewed that much. But what happens is that the new president stands on the steps, and there is a parade of our five military, where they take the oath of allegiance basically to the newly elected president who's their commander in chief, and it's acknowledging the civil authority that belongs to the people, not to the military. It's that peaceful transfer that has been so effective for us. President Trump is challenging that. You know, if he has a specific situation where he thinks there is a need for a recount, fine, he can do that. But to be asserting without evidence, constantly, that it was a fraudulent election. And then he's got a big voice and persuades a lot of people that that's the case without evidence. He's unraveling the trust in a democracy that is more essential even than the Constitution. You know, the Constitution is incredibly important, but we need trust in one another and trust in our institutions. And the basic institution of a democratic election and its outcome is absolutely fundamentally essential to the well-being of our democracy and our citizenry. President Trump is trashing that, and it's absolutely outrageous.
Is it a self-coup?
He's attempting to stay in power despite being voted out of office. So I'll let people use the definition that they want, but it's totally undemocratic what he's doing.
Let's go to Sal, who's calling in from Barnett. Hi, Sal. Go right ahead. What's your question or thought for Congressman Welch?
Well, thank you for taking my call. And Congressman Welch, you certainly have my support politically. I have been looking with some interest, and there doesn't seem to be much coverage about Trump's failure to contract with Pfizer about additional doses of the vaccine, and even read something about it where we weren't expecting to get more vaccine from them until the middle of June or June of 21. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on this and what might be the another solution. Are there other vendors that we will be dealing with, or are we just stuck?
And let me just clarify for people who to catch everybody up to speed on this news. It came out, I think, yesterday that a former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration said that that President Trump had passed earlier this year on the possibility of ordering more doses from Pfizer of their vaccine, which, again, has not yet been approved by the United States, but that there was this idea that the U.S. could sort of reserve more than 100 million doses, which it has reserved. And the assertion is that President Trump passed on that opportunity, and that may then delay the U.S. being able to get more doses of the vaccine, because other countries have now claimed and ordered doses of the vaccine, which, of course, takes a while to be produced. Sorry to interrupt, Congressman.
No, I appreciate you giving that background, because we don't know what the full story is yet, but that is what has been reported. And what that would indicate to me is incredible mismanagement on the part of the Trump administration. And one of the things that I find so alarming about the president's going from court to court, sending Rudy Giuliani in, and basically trying to fire lots of people in his administration, is that he's not paying attention to the day job he has. He's president until January 20th. He has the authority, and he is the one who has to focus on our behalf on what is the best way for us to get our folks vaccinated. And that failure to act really smacks of a decision that wasn't made or wasn't evaluated, because the president was not doing his job and was spending all his time in these other pursuits. So we're just going to have to make up for it. But if it turns out that we literally had the opportunity to get those vaccines and they would have been distributed sooner to more people in our country, then that is yet another blemish on, from my perspective, a pretty bad record of Trump management.
Congressman, we got a note from Boca, who tweets, "I noticed the House quickly and overwhelmingly approved a $741 billion defense budget for the Pentagon by a veto-proof margin." Boca wants to know, what's the secret of such quick bipartisan action? And, you know, again, just to catch people up to speed, I believe this is a bill that you passed today, right, that is this defense policy bill, and had faced a presidential veto threat, weirdly, because of whether or not it would include some clamping down on social media companies, because President Trump has said they were biased against him during the election. But this is a veto-proof majority. So just talk a little bit about that bill and then what the secret is, quote-unquote secret is.
The secret is there was a lack of controversy about it. That's the National Defense Authorization Bill. In fact, I voted against it because of the top line number. I mean, the amount we're spending on defense has been exploding, and we've been giving the defense more than they've even asked for. So I do think that we obviously have to have a strong national defense, but I don't think we should just be ever increasing that budget without even beyond what the military is requesting. But there is a broad consensus between Republicans and Democrats about the importance of having national security in a robust defense budget. So it simply doesn't have the conflict that's associated with many other things in Congress. And that's the answer to that. But I actually like the point that the question presents. If you can cooperate on something like the defense budget, and it's a big number and a big commitment, why can't you do that on aid to our fellow men and women in this country, our citizens, who are facing the onslaught of something that's completely beyond their control? And all I can say to the callers, I'm doing everything I can, and I've indicated, been a big voice in our caucus with the speaker, that we've got to compromise. It's not our way or the highway. We have to do everything we can to try to help people get through this.
Given the extremely wide margin on that bill's passage, would you characterize your vote against it as a protest vote? Would you have voted in the same way if it were closer, given what you said about the need to maintain a defense budget versus your desire to say we're spending too much on the military?
I didn't have to face that question, but I'm really concerned about how much we're allocating to the Defense Department. You know, in this round, and I've seen this happen before, the Pentagon had a request, and Congress decided to give them way more than what even the Pentagon requested. So my view is that that has a lot less to do with defense than it does with individual members basically trying to get money for their programs, or individual members trying to politicize the defense budget by making it sound as though the more you spend, the stronger we are. And that's not true. You've got to spend wisely. You've got to have careful policies. And that's my concern. So I am a voice in the Congress who's saying, look, let's take a look at how we're spending our money. Let's try to figure out what our budget needs to do, not just how high the number can be.
Let's talk a little bit about student debt relief. I think we've got a couple of callers who want to talk about this. So let's go first to Cindy, who's calling in from Barrie. Hi, Cindy. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It seems to me that many of the folks that have been allowed to defer student loan payments have been adding to the economy in ways they've not been able to do in the past due to the amount of student debt they have. And while they have been able to pay down their debt interest-free right now, they also have been able to invest in our economy. And I'm wondering if that's one reason the stock market is up and also product buying is up. It seems that by getting rid of student debt, we could increase the economy, therefore saving small businesses and jobs. And I know we have an extension now for deferment until the end of January. Are there conversations happening with the president-elect and his team, as well as Congress and the Senate, about reducing the massive amount of student debt that citizens have in the U.S.?
Cindy, before we get an answer to your question, let me just loop in Jonathan in Brattleboro. Jonathan, you also want to talk about student debt?
Yes, definitely. Thank you for taking my call. I definitely agree with Cindy's concerns. You know, I would echo that and emphasize that canceling student loan debt can be a really significant economic stimulus. And I think it would also be really meaningful because it would be a clear statement that our elected officials support working people over the interests of corporations and the financial sector. You know, it would show that these debts, like so many other unjust economic arrangements that are so clear to us during this pandemic right now, are things that we can change. They're not immutable. They're not untouchable. They're social relations that show where our priorities lie as a society, and they're things that we can change to support people in this country. So I'm really interested to hear Congressman Welch's answer to this question.
Yeah, thanks to both of you for posing that question. Representative Welch, we know that President-elect Joe Biden has talked a lot about the problem of student loans and student debt. And I believe he's said that what he'd like to do once he's in office is cancel $10,000 worth of student loans immediately for every borrower. But there are other proposals that have been presented to him. What's your position?
Well, that's a start, but the callers are absolutely right. The student debt burden is a millstone around young people trying to start out. And as the first caller mentioned, if you're paying a student debt, a huge student debt, are you going to be able to put a down payment on your first condominium or house? Are you going to be able to buy a car? And the answer to that is no. And there's a lot of people who are working really hard in their 40s and their 50s still and are carrying around a mountain of student debt. So I have been a longtime advocate of significant reduction in student debt. Whether we could cancel it or not, that obviously would be what would ultimately be wonderful for anybody who had any debt. But there's some folks who have debt that's reasonable and they can pay it. But my advocacy here is one, I totally support the suspension and interest isn't accumulating. Number two, we should renegotiate student debt at a very minimum. You know, some folks are paying 6 or 7% interest rates, and parents who have borrowed money for their kids to help them out or on Parent Plus loans are paying 7 and 8%. That's outrageous. The federal government is borrowing money in many cases at less than 1%. So Senator Warren and I are both advocates of renegotiating the interest rates so that borrowers are essentially paying about what the government is paying, and that would provide immense relief to folks and let them get a start in contributing into the economy. So I do agree with the callers that the mountain of student debt that has been allowed to accumulate is just a real burden on them, and it's a real burden on our economy. And I will be all in on being as aggressive as we possibly can be to provide relief.
Could you comment on what was announced by the University of Vermont last week? I know this isn't something that you'll be dealing with as a congressman, but obviously as a representative of Vermont who's interested in looking at higher education and the access to higher education that Vermont students may have, administrators at UVM last week said that they were going to cut 12 majors and 11 minors and some master's programs from the College of Arts and Sciences, and they're pointing to a budget deficit. And as you know from your long time serving in the Vermont legislature, funding the state college system and UVM has been a major problem, and it's really been coming home to roost in the last year or so as we look at the budgets and the possibility of some of these schools maybe closing in the future. So can you address the issue with UVM now as well?
Well, I don't know the particulars about UVM other than what you described, but it's gut-wrenching. I mean, to have our flagship liberal arts college having a discussion about the economic forces that are compelling them to have these hard discussions about programs that might have to be cut is really, really brutal. My view is that what's happened in higher education over the years is that, to some extent, with all the going from grants to loans, is that it's been easy to raise tuition, and tuitions have gone up to unsustainable levels. I'm really happy that at UVM, for the past 3 years, they have not raised tuition. It's a real acknowledgement of what the burden is on the students and on the families. But the long-term approach here, I think, has to include significant federal support, hopefully more state support. I mean, that is a huge challenge for a tight budget in a state like Vermont, where there's a lot of needs, including the ever-escalating cost of health care that are eating into our state budget constantly. But I do think that our administrators also have to do what UVM appears to be doing recently, and that is to put a lid on tuition, because the answer can't be ever-escalating tuition with then students having to borrow ever-escalating amounts and then graduate from college with ever-escalating debt burden.
It's tricky, though. I mean, and we won't have this whole conversation in today's show, but Henry Epp interviewed one of the deans at the University of Vermont, the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Bill Falls, who said that they'd been dealing with a structural deficit for 5 years. And so if you're not placing that burden on students and student tuition, it appears that what you are going to do to make the budget balanced is to have to cut programs. And so, you know, it's one or the other in some ways.
Well, that's the real world challenges that the administrators at our higher education institutions have to face. You know, I'm a huge fan of liberal arts. I actually think it's an extraordinarily good foundation for an education. But I think what the dean is talking about with the structural deficit is that students are choosing other majors. So at a certain point, how do you maintain the finances? And those are concrete and practical questions. But I do think the federal government has to have a role. You know, we have a tradition in the state of leadership on education. Think about Jim Jeffords, who was a longtime member of Congress and longtime senator. Bob Stafford, the great Vermont senator from Rutland, Vermont, the Stafford Education Loan Program. I mean, we believe in education here, including liberal arts education. So all of us have to be doing what we can to try to right the ship here so that it's a financially sustainable commitment to what I think is really important, liberal arts education, as well as the other STEM components of education.
We just have a minute left with you, so why don't I throw one more really big topic at you. But Sarah in Marshfield writes, not highest on the list of priorities, but the changes in the postal system are seen locally as our post office, without overtime, isn't able to do their jobs as well as they used to. Any updates?
There's a postal reform bill that we're trying to get through Congress. We've got it. We've made progress on it, but essentially it tries to right-size the financing. Right now, the post office is laboring under a requirement that they advance fund for 75 years their pension and their health care obligations, and it's a millstone around their services. So we do need congressional action. The post office has been with us longer than the Constitution. Benjamin Franklin started it, and we need it.
Sarah says not the highest on the list of priorities. Where would you place it? It sounds like it is kind of a high priority. It certainly is for many people.
Oh, no, it is. It is a high priority. You know, I serve on the Oversight Committee and have been for a number of years, and we have jurisdiction over postal. So it's been something that I and some colleagues have been working on for a number of years.
Well, Congressman Welch, I really appreciate you taking the time on a busy day. Some important votes happening today in the House of Representatives. So thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.